Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we open a batch of fan mail about the year 1991.
Oh, excellent. There's a record I forgot to mention on the original episode.
Okay, but will it take long? I mean, we have a lot of comments to read.
No, not too long. It's just my essay on Jethro Tull's Catfish Rising.
Wow. Okay, Patrick, it's time for some more fan mail.
Yes, crack open the bags. Yeah, yep. The cards and letters keep coming.
Well, as we've discussed, sometimes it takes a while for us to get to it, but we try to always get to it.
Yeah.
And this episode, we're going to address some correspondence that came to us back in like March and April. We did an episode on March 30th. It was a patron episode with Noah Crane, and it was about three albums that released in 1991 that he thought made 1991 a really great year in music, and that was R.E.M.'s Out of Time, Matthew Sweet's Girlfriend, and U2's Octoon Baby. So we talked about those albums, and I think just in general, you know, some of the other key releases of 1991. Right. Without getting into necessarily the really big one that happened that year.
That's right. Anyway.
But of course, this prompted people to also, you know, talk about those albums and some other records from 1991. So let's dive into this. The show is called Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And here's a comment from Mike Wagner down in Houston, Texas. Mike says, my first trip to London was in November of 1991. I bought my copy of Octoon Baby in Piccadilly Circus. I think it is one of their best, as with many albums of that time, when CDs became the main medium for an album, I think it is too long and could do with some editing. Although I know most people like Until the End of the World and Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses, to me they are not that good, but some really great songs are on the record. The Fly kicks, and the really underrated song to me is So Cruel. So that's Mike's take on Octoon Baby.
Okay.
I disappeared in you. You disappeared from me. I gave you everything you ever wanted. It wasn't what you wanted. The men who love you, you hate the most. They pass right through you like a ghost. They look for you, but your spirit is in the air. Baby, you're nowhere.
I like those two hit songs that you mentioned, so I'm fine with that. But I know what he's getting at. I think we've talked about this before too. That when CDs became the dominant medium, bands would just, you know, and the label I think maybe pushed them to fill all that time.
Yeah.
Right.
We got 80 minutes. Let's go.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Painful.
So in some cases that can hurt the record in some people's eyes. But then again, you know, you can always hit skip on the CD. So.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Or program it,
which you couldn't
do back in the days
before then. Yeah. Or not so easily. All right, thanks for that, Mike. And we have a note here from Ted Borey. This is an interesting one because it's not specifically about a record that came out in 91, but relates to it. So he says, if you haven't listened, check out Matthew Sweet's Kimi ga Suki Refu, only released in Japan in 2003 with the same lineup as Girlfriend and damn near as good. It was also written and recorded in a week. Unreal. So I looked this up. So Matthew Sweet, he had a good following in Japan.
Yeah.
And if you remember from the Girlfriend era, like his videos were like anime and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think he's always kind of had some kind of association with Japanese culture. But he did release this record in 2003, but you can find it now on streaming services and possibly even physical copies here too. But initially it was sort of a gift to the Japanese fans.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's very cool. I don't know it at all, but I see now looking that Richard Lloyd plays guitar on the record, so How can you go wrong with that?
Yeah, so check that out. I have listened to it, and, you know, it's great stuff. He puts out great pop music, so... And it's not in Japanese.
That's the other thing I wanted to say before. Right? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really cool. So, that actually came out in 03. So, check out that record, people.
Fantastic. All right. Yeah.
Okay. Now, this I want to play for you something here now, Patrick. Okay?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, our friend Rob Gates, he said, regarding 1991, he said the album Left of Center by 9 Days Wonder... It is probably one of the best albums you have never heard and one of my favorites to this day, okay? Mm-hmm. And he gave us a picture here of his CD, 9 Days Wonder, Left of Center. I tried to find if I could listen to this anywhere, and I could not find it anywhere. And I will tell you, there appears to have been a band in the 70s also called 9 Days Wonder that is not this band, okay?
Not that band, okay. Right.
This band is out of Eugene, Oregon, and I know Rob lived in Oregon for a while, so that... Probably makes sense why he would have discovered this band. I asked him for more information, and I also asked him to rip the CD for me and send it. So I've got some stuff here to play, but let me read for you what he wrote to me in regard to this record.
Okay.
Okay, so Rob wrote that there's a guy named Dave Coey, C-O-E-Y, is the man behind this band, 9 Days Wonder. But he said the band itself was made up of musicians that remain fixtures in the Portland, Eugene, Americana rock scene. Though he says, I'm not... quite sure really what genre this band would be classified in.
Okay.
Said, Coey wrote most of the songs and played bass. Mike Walker played the Hammond B3, which is such a huge part of their sound. Peter Bach, who now plays with a well-known Jerry Garcia cover band, was the rhythm guitarist. Ben Sturgill was lead guitarist and is still around someplace. Phil White was the drummer on the album, but I think their live guy may have been someone else. Notable on the Left of Center album is that Steve Kimmock, who is still big in the San Francisco music scene, played on a few of the tracks, so these guys were gaining some notable attention. He says, I saw them several times when living in Portland and absolutely fell in love with the music and the songs. I guess some bands just click with some people, and this one did with me. More so, I think, he says, Coey's later bands were all fantastic, but I always love when they bring back an old 9 Days tune. Also, the whole 9 Days catalog did not make the album, but exist in several recordings on archive.org. Members of the band also gig together from time to time, either as member reunion shows or playing an old song or two at some of Coey's more recent gigs. It is all part of the Oregon jam band scene. So there you go, jam bands again. Okay. Coey's own catalog is enormous, and his lyrics remind me a lot of Robbie Robertson in some ways, but Merle Haggard in others.
Wow.
He says, I talked to him once about touring nationally. His band Renegade Saints, which followed 9 Days, I believe toured throughout the states west of the Rockies. He told me labels didn't like them because they couldn't nail down the genre of his songs. Again, some blues, some country, some pop, so it was somewhat unmarketable to the masses. This was in the early 90s, so entirely plausible. Also, this was the Northwest, and all the labels were seeking the next Nirvana. There it goes.
Yeah, well.
Okay, so you mentioned a couple of different songs, but he says one song called High Road to Heaven. Rob describes it as a musical and lyrical masterpiece. All right, there you go. 9 Days Wonder, High Road to Heaven. I did hear that Hammond B3.
Oh, totally,
back
man.
There.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. And I could see this being, you know, part of like a jam band scene. It has that kind of bounce that we talked about with Mike Coley, right?
Mm-hmm. And you get groove. The sensation. Yeah, exactly. You get the sensation of cruising along, you know, with a forested landscape and a big blue sky. And you get kind of that wide open feel to it, which is cool, too. You know, that I haven't spent a lot of time in the Northwest, but kind of what I would imagine, you know, that feels like.
Yeah, I always like it when somebody highlights or brings to us, you know, just a band who had some regional success somewhere.
Yeah.
especially in the pre-streaming days where the stuff just wasn't available any other way, right? So
yeah, and it's still not. That's really right. Fascinating, too. That's always something we've talked about before and find really interesting. In these days of information deluge, it's not even out there. That's pretty cool.
So I have this music now, Patrick. I can send it your way.
Great.
All right. Okay. Thank you for that, Rob.
Thank you, Rob.
And let's see. Just getting back to some 1991 stuff just real quick. My friend Will Pfeiffer, he commented, he said, I always remember the summer of 1991 as being dominated by those two Use Your Illusion albums from Guns N' Roses. that was before Nevermind arrived, because, yeah, Nevermind was released in the fall, right?
Came in the fall, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then he says, my favorite album of the year was definitely the Pixies' Trompe Le Mans. So. There you go. But I do want to talk real quickly about that Guns N' Roses thing. A couple of days ago, we were talking about the whole Kiss phenomenon where they released the four solo albums at the same time, right? And that was, you know, that's a totally different thing here. But there was a marketing gimmick here where put out, instead of a double album, put out two single albums on the same day, right?
With the same title.
Yes, right.
Part one and two, yeah. Right.
Which really, I guess, was a way to just get people to spend even more money, because you could charge more for two single albums than you could one double
album.
That's
right. Yeah, it's exactly. So thanks, Guns N' Roses. Yeah.
And it was a big deal. There was a lot of anticipation for that because, where are we, 91? When did Appetite for Destruction was like, it was 87.
Yeah, so that's right.
It had been 4 years since then, and they put out, there was that GNR Lies album, which had like Patience on it and stuff like that, but that was really like, an acoustic record. It wasn't really this was really the official follow-up, I think, to Appetite for Destruction, and it was such a big deal. And like really about the last thing they did, so I don't know,
more or less. Never really got around to finishing anything else.
Not too much. Not, at least not that collection of GNR, but anyway.
Yeah,
It was a big deal. That was an interesting year. Okay, Mike Wagner again came in and said, from 1991, he said, I really liked Mighty Like a Rose by Elvis Costello. It was a couple of songs too long. Again, Mike, I said, but I always liked that album. Do you remember that record?
I do, yeah. I remember some of it. It's in a period where it seemed like he was starting to put out a lot of stuff and kind of branching out in different directions with different things. But yeah.
I'm looking at it right now. It is 54 minutes, 14 songs. And the first time I saw Elvis Costello was on this tour. I remember, because this one, he had a single and a video for this song called The Other Side of Summer. And that's the opening track.
Right. I remember that tune.
And,
yeah.
So he was touring, and he was at that point playing like amphitheaters, like big amphitheaters.
Yeah.
I was in Illinois then. We drove, like all amphitheaters, drove like some period of time single that seemed to take forever. Yeah. I think it was called
Cornfield.
If I'm remembering correctly, Chicago had a couple of amphitheaters, you know, out in like the surrounding area. But I think this one was called the World Music Theater, if I remember correctly. And it was pretty gigantic. And yeah, one of those deals. But that was fun. That was the first time I saw him. And yeah, The Other Side of Summer was kind of a snarky song, because it's kind of like, as I recall, I haven't listened in a long time, but it's kind of Beach Boys-esque, but it's more like a dark song lyrically. So it's like, you know, interesting song. Like
oh,
that.
Interesting.
And, you know,
okay.
It's Elvis Costello. You know, he crafts the stuff really well.
Go back and revisit that for sure. The sun struggles up another beautiful day, and I felt glad in my own suspicious way.
All right, and then, oh, this is a two-parter. This is somebody commenting on Facebook and then another person commenting on that comment, right? So it starts with our friend Echo Park Jimmy, and he says he had already covered this with us, probably one of his dispatches to us, but he said, what is it with the shiny, happy people hate?
Yeah.
It's a huge hit, a catchy hook, stellar vocals, real lyrics for once. It's not that bad, he says. He really emphasizes it. And then he says, it's sure better than low, 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 low. Really, people? That's what he
really
says.
Really, people?
I like low, but okay. And then Craig Rosen chimed in and said, it's almost a cliche to not like Stand and Shiny Happy People. It's almost as bad as saying REM sucked after leaving IRS Records.
Hi, folks.
So there you go.
There you go. Double dose. Yeah. And I'll tell you, just looking back at some of these records once again in 91, I know we touched on a lot, but wow, it was one of those years where all these different forces came together. Really,
I know.
Kind of amazing. Yeah. And I'll tell you, probably the record that we played the most, at least in the garage where we hung out in 1991, was Spiderland by Slint. We just played that thing so many times because it only had six songs or something on it.
Yeah.
But every one was really good.
Yeah. So many great releases that year. So go back and check that out. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for commenting on stuff.
Thank
we love
you,
it.
Noah Crane, for stimulating everyone's thoughts on that one.
We love to hear from the community.
Always.
And all the different perspectives. So, all right. We'll get back to fan mail soon.
Yeah, I think so.
I think we have a few more things we need to address with that. So, okay.
It's always good.
The way you can correspond with us, of course, is to call 612-440-1984. Or email rock@suburbspod.com, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those at Suburbs Pod, or track down intern Matt and, you know, slip him $20 and he'll get you right at the top of the stack if you want to go that way.
Yeah.
That's $20 Canadian. Or there's
right.
the flaming arrow method. There's
that
the
works.
Stick your head out the window and yell method. Is there anything else? I think we talked about skywriting. If you know
Skywriting,
people want to do
definite possibility smoke signals,
it seems like
you want Morse code, any of those things will work.
We don't have the Skywriting account set up yet, but when we do,
that's right, expensive to get started.
When we do, we'll let you guys know.
Yeah,
all right.
It's got to be a company called Skywritely or something like that.
Yes, one of those like peer to peer things. They've cut out the middleman on the Skywriting.
Rent a Skywriter. Share it with the community.
That's such a bizarre thing when you think about it. You know, you and I, where we live now in the mid-Atlantic, in normal years at least, you know, we'd go to the beach, right?
Yeah.
It's a great summer vacation, go to the beach. And what do you see at the beach? You see the banners.
Pulled by the plane. Yeah.
And I love it. It's like part of the fun of being at the beach. It's just like,
absolutely.
You know, stuff like that, right?
It's a genius idea. You got such a captive audience
right
there.
Right. It's so great. And then sometimes you'll see the big like billboard boats that go past, right?
Yeah.
Back and forth along. And all that makes perfect sense. It seems, like you said, it's a captive audience and it's, you know, you get the message there. Everybody's looking at everything. But like skywriting, that's an effort. Like you got to sit there and like fly in a certain way and spell this out. And then the clouds start to dissipate before you get to the end of the message. And like,
we got
to
keep it short.
I don't know how that works. Like I don't know if there's any
Skywritely or solving those problems.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, if there's any, you know, meteorological scientists out there in the group that can explain like how this, you know, what's the key to good skywriting,
what are the optimal weather conditions. <That's>
We need to know these things. Okay, let's get out of here.
It's
Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster,
and we'll talk to you guys later.
When he woke, there was no trace of the ship. Only the dawn was left behind by the storm. Stairs beneath him that rose from the sea to the door.
We got 80 minutes. Let's go.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.